Anger in Iran's flyover country, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. A fifth day of anti-government protests in cities across Iran, including some that this Mideast correspondent had never heard of.
And I think that is striking. These people in these unknown places, Iran's flyover country, emerging from the woodworks and finding their voice.
It's not clear if the protests threaten the Iranian government, but this Tehran resident says people there are concerned.
We are really confused. We're talking about it, where it can take us, where it can take the country, and we are worried.
Plus, how new regulations in China could disrupt how we recycle here in the U.S.
This is not a little disruption.
Those stories just ahead here on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. Happy New Year. 2018 is getting off to an extraordinary start in Iran. People there took to the streets for a fifth day today in towns and cities across the country. The first anti-government protest began in a provincial city last Thursday as an apparently spontaneous demonstration against price hikes. Now, crowds are chanting for the end of the Islamic Republic and, in some instances, for the restoration of the Shah or King. President Hassan Rouhani has said Iranians have the right to peaceful protest, and government forces are showing restraint, but there has been some violence. State-run television reported 10 people killed Sunday night in clashes with security forces, and tonight there are reports a police officer has been shot dead and three more wounded. We reached Roya Sadat Mehr, a translator in Tehran, to find out more.
Where I live, it's very calm. You cannot see people out in the streets protesting. But from friends who have been to the center of the city, I've heard that people are out in the streets and the police force is out more than previous nights. So, yeah, it's still on.
And are people talking about it a lot?
Well, we talk about it with our family members, friends, colleagues. Because it's a little bit weird. We didn't expect it. It came all of a sudden in Mashhad, and then it just ran through all other cities and towns. We are confused because it all started by the hardliners, and then it got derailed by other protesters. So we are really confused. We're talking about it, where it can take us, where it can take the country, and we are worried.
So, Roya, just to make sure I'm understanding you, and I understand you're saying it's weird and confusing, but what seems to have happened from what you can work out is that the original protests were started by hardline elements, but that the nature of the protests led to other kinds of people coming out and expressing their frustration. Is that right?
Exactly. And now you hear different slogans. For example, at Tehran University, you could hear students who were chanting death to Rouhani, and they were asking for Rouhani to resign. And also you could hear students who were chanting for releasing the political prisoners. So people have different ideas and different demands.
How are the protests being portrayed on state television, state media channels?
For the first couple of days, they tried to ignore it, as they always did. But then they started to say that these people are people who are being manipulated by the enemy from the outside of the country. And they haven't actually shown the real protest and different voices of the protesters. They have just tried to kind of scare people not to join them because these people are against the national security of the country, and they are just destroying the public properties.
Do you actually know anybody who's protesting?
This time, all the people I know were very active in the protest in 2009, are not participating in the protests.
And why do you think?
Because they believe this is something internal. This can make a big chaos for the country. And the results will not be something profitable for people. So that's why they say that let's wait and see what will happen. And most of people I know, they believe in reforms. Of course, people have the right to protest and say what they want or what they don't want. But with this kind of protest that is usually cracked down by the authorities, people cannot get what they want. And the situation can be the opposite. Usually after the protests, they make it more, restricted.
You sound like you're worried about where this could lead.
Yeah, I am indeed.
Roya Sadat Mir, speaking to us from Tehran, thank you very, very much for your thoughts on this.
You're welcome. Thank you for talking to me.
Borzu Dargahi joins me now. He's covering the story for BuzzFeed News. I think the big question, Borzu, is the regime in peril?
You know, that's still not clear yet. If I had to decide one way or the other, I would say no, it's not in peril for a number of reasons, including the fact that this movement doesn't appear to have a leadership or a structure. It doesn't seem to have a coherent ideology or political platform. And it has not, I think this is key, been able to reach out to certain segments of the middle class who are by and large standing on the sidelines of this uprising. They're not participating. So what I'm saying is that almost none of the people who I know participated in the 2009 uprising, and that was big, and that was in the big cities, are participating in this one. Because it's either from a different class strata or a different age group. There's no overlap there. And that is going to seriously limit their ability to grow and to coalesce into a real movement, as well as give the regime a certain amount of impunity when it decides, as it is deciding, to use violence to crack down.
It's so curious, though. Different class of people, different strata perhaps, but 25 cities, seemingly quite spontaneous, and if not gathering steam, certainly perpetuating itself. What do you make of the signals you're reading and seeing?
I think that there's a lot of people in Iran who are very, very angry. And I've been hearing this anger every time I've gone to Iran. People who are feeling just under so much pressure because of the economic situation, the inflation, the lack of job opportunities, the crumbling infrastructure, the inability to improve one's lot, the struggle for young people getting a job and getting married and living through the normal sort of rights of adulthood. This is a big issue in Iran, as it was, for example, in Tunisia in 2010-11 and in Syria, where those economic grievances of people who are in semi-rural enclaves or newly urbanized people who have just come to the city and are having a really hard time, those are the people who kind of drove the Arab Spring uprisings in Tunisia and Syria. I think that this is that same strata of the population that is taking part in this. And they seem to be, it's kind of interesting, borrowing certain slogans from Iranian political movements of the past, coming up with some new ones as well. But they seem to be kind of trying to come up with some kind of political platform. But there doesn't seem to be any kind of focal point or center to this movement.
Are you even hearing a coherent demand?
I haven't heard anything. I haven't heard a coherent demand. I think it's just a lot of pent-up anger and a lot of frustration. You've had these sorts of sporadic outbursts of anger over the last few years in the provinces, especially over unpaid wages, banks going under and swallowing up people's money, people, you know, being flummoxed or enraged about price hike here and there. But this is a much more serious threat to the regime, a much more serious threat to Rouhani. And I think that the president is being wise right now, the President Rouhani, by not throwing any more fuel on the fire. So in 2009, when the protesters were out in the street protesting against Ahmadinejad, he very unwisely, in this sort of, I guess, proto-Trump-like gesture, he called them dust and dirt. You have nothing like that from the Rouhani administration. They've been very cool and calm and sort of speaking about the demands, the legitimate demands of the people, the legitimate rights of the people. But we have to put some limits on, you know, vandalism and riots and so on. We can't allow that. But he's been very careful not to insult the protesters.
It'll be interesting to see how long he can keep that up, because presumably there will be quite a strong struggle between him and the hardliners about whether to put it out.
I think that's a really good observation. I think he's going to start coming under pressure from the hardliners to let them unleash the full force of the security apparatus. He has been resisting that so far, but at some point he's going to look like a weakling to them and they're going to put him under pressure. But I think that Rouhani, given his very cautious nature, even if they do allow the security apparatus to have greater freedom in terms of how they handle this situation, he'll at least embark on a cooler tone with regard to the public rhetoric, and that will probably help them stave off this crisis.
Borzu, what's been the most striking or surprising detail in all this for you?
I mean, you see these videos from these towns that I've never heard of. And, you know, the analysts I talk to have never heard of these little places. They're like county seats of 50,000 people, not even on a main highway between two main cities, like really far off places. And these people are coming out in the streets and they're, you know, they're protesting and they're, you know, responding to calls on social media, but they're also responding to, I guess, a sense of humiliation they felt at being neglected by the central government, being neglected by the authorities, not having their needs met, not having any political representation among the elite. And I think that is striking. These people in these unknown places, Iran's flyover country, emerging from the woodworks and finding their voice.
Do you have any idea what this feels like to older Iranians who experienced the revolution? You know, what it's like for them when these movements bubble up every few years?
I think that's another problem, too, with the radical slogans that they're chanting. That's a really good point, because, you know, Iranians have been through this kind of political chaos so many times right now that many of the older ones, even if their politics are very radical in terms of how they implement those politics, in terms of how they want the country to progress, there's a really strong core of people in the middle class, in the lower middle class, who are very much in favor of slow reform over any kind of radical rift. They say, we've experienced radical rift. Radical rifts kind of suck, and they ruin people's lives, and they tear away savings, and they cause people to flee into exile, and you never see them again. We don't want to go through that again. We want a slow, undramatic change over the course of years, because we've experienced the other way around.
And finally, with all this uncertainty, what are you going to be looking for to help you understand what's next?
I'm going to be looking for numbers and magnitude. I mean, I see videos that show maybe 100, 200 people protesting in these little towns. I see like 400 or 500 people protesting in downtown Tehran. That's not enough to change a regime. They're going to need more numbers. They're going to need to draw people from the middle class. They need to draw those people who were in the streets in 2009 to have much greater impact. Little sporadic protests like this are not going to bring down the regime.
Borzu Daragahi of BuzzFeed News is following events in Iran from his base in Istanbul. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
China wants our recycling, but not our trash. How that could impact you just ahead on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. After you collect your cans and bottles and put them out by the curb for recycling, do you ever think about where they go after the truck picks them up? A lot of our recycling gets shipped overseas. Most of it goes to China, or it used to. Starting today, China is enforcing new regulations that will affect our recycling here. Joining me now is The World's Jason Margolis. Jason, so how much of our stuff does go to China now?
Well, let me paint a visual for you. Every day, close to 4,000 shipping containers filled with recyclables leave U.S. ports for China. So China sends us toys, they send us clothes, whatever. And one of our largest exports back to them, cans, bottles, and paper.
So what's changing?
The new policy China is enacting is called National Sword, and it bans various plastics. And it also sets a much tougher bar for the contamination levels for paper. So what that means is when we send off our bundles of paper to China, sometimes there's junk that's mixed in. Someone puts in their pizza box and it's greasy. They can't recycle that. So that is contaminated material. So China has now set a very high bar, saying only 0.5% of that paper can be contaminated. That's a very high bar.
And what is driving this new strict approach?
Well, China is tired of being the world's garbage dump. So 5 years ago, they enacted a policy called the Green Fence, and that set some more rigid standards. And this is just ratcheting things up. China's saying, we don't want to be dirty and contaminated by your stuff anymore.
And this starts today.
This starts today.
So we're going to hear now about what's happening in China because of this, and then we're going to come back to you, Jason, to hear more about how this policy is affecting us here in the U.S. We begin on the outskirts of Shanghai with our BBC colleague, Robin Brandt.
These children are crouching on a riverbank, picking up dead fish amid plastic bottles and bags. China has become a much richer but much dirtier country. It's blighted by homemade pollution and contamination on a vast scale. The government claims some foreign waste is dangerous, and the last thing this country needs is even more of that. Wang Wang is from the China Scrap Plastics Association.
China's ban is putting the onus back on all the waste exporting countries. You need to shoulder the responsibility of disposing your own waste and your own sources of pollution.
The ban presents a problem for China, though. It needs the paper, the cardboard, the clean, high-quality polystyrene that's simple to ship to this country and simple to turn into something you can then sell. This is an industrial chipper. It disintegrates polystyrene, tons of it. The business on the outskirts of Shanghai ships them, chips them, heats them, and then turns them into something to sell. Back to you.
In a nutshell, it's pretty simple what they do here. They take this, this is a bit of polystyrene. It's compressed and sent here to China, and then they turn it into this. These are little green pellets of plastic about the size of half a peanut, and then eventually it's molded into this, photo frames.
This is core components, all German.
And it cuts it, and then it comes out.
Yes, coming out.
But China's ban means the boss is going to have to send his UK waste elsewhere. Frank Liu said it will hit his supply.
Some people in China are very angry about importing of recycled plastic. But just keep the factory running, we need about 50,000 tons of recycled plastics. When you only recycle China, it's not enough.
The ban on foreign waste will hurt some business here, but the government's view is tough. Delivering a cleaner China is paramount for the Communist Party politicians. A green revolution, you might call it.
The BBC's Robin Brandt there. He mentioned that China's new ban will have an impact in the UK. I'm back with Jason Margolis. And Jason, you say it's also already having an impact here in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. I saw this recently firsthand when I drove out to Westboro, Massachusetts. That's about 45 minutes west of Boston here. And I met with Ben Harvey, president of E.L. Harvey & Sons. He's fourth generation in the waste and recycling business. We stood in his parking lot staring at mountains of bundled paper.
We're looking at about 150 to 200 tractor-trailer loads of paper. It's stacked approximately 12 feet high, and it goes for quite a distance.
And so with this is not normal?
No, our business is to bring it in, process it, and move it out as quickly as we can.
Harvey can't sell these 2,000-pound bales because the contamination levels, the extra trash that's accidentally mixed in, almost certainly exceeds China's rigorous new standards. He's hoping that China can work out a deal with the U.S., or he can find other processing mills in Vietnam or Thailand. As for the U.S., that's simply not a short-term option.
Because everything was going offshore, the mills have been slow to develop in the United States to handle this material. With the tightness in the marketplace, there might be mills that will be built, but that takes 4 to 5 to 6 years to put in a mill that'll handle the capacity that we're currently looking at.
In the meantime, he grows increasingly concerned as the bales of paper take over more and more of his parking lot.
If this stuff doesn't move and we don't know what to do with it, we can't keep it forever. At some point, it's going to start to degrade. So the other thing that could happen is if we can't find outlets, and I'm not talking about just E.L. Harvey and Sons, I'm talking about the industry as a whole, we're going to stop bringing material into our facilities, and that's going to impact recycling programs throughout the country.
So what does that mean for me? If I live in Westboro, you're just going to stop collecting my recycling?
That could happen.
This is not a little disruption. You know, this is a big disruption to a bigger industry than most people would think it is, because it's sort of an invisible process.
That's Susan Collins, president of the Container Recycling Institute, a research organization based in Southern California. She says China's crackdown presents something between a challenge and a crisis for U.S. recyclers.
We've already put things on ships that may be coming back. The U.S. recycling industry has asked for some relaxation of the rules, but there are sort of ongoing negotiations right now that in the hopes of making this not quite as drastic a move.
She says U.S. recyclers are willing to adjust, but they need time, and so do you and I. American consumers are making it hard on recycling collectors like Ben Harvey. Again, China's new policy will only allow paper with a 0.5% contamination. Harvey says he can't come anywhere close to that. Inside his plant, streams of cans, bottles, and paper roll by on conveyor belts. A machine sorts things first, then workers do a second manual sort. Along with bottles and cans, they're picking out a lot of trash. About 15% of the recycling he collects is unusable.
Yeah, we call it wishful recycling. The general public says, hey, let's put it in the recycling barrel. You know, they'll figure something to do with it.
His machines and workers do the best they can, but the end product is still far too contaminated to meet China's new standards. Harvey estimates that he can keep storing bales of paper in his parking lot for another 3 to 6 months. If a solution isn't found by then, it could mean shuttering the plant and layoffs. And that could also mean sending bottles, cans, and paper straight to the landfill. For The World, Jason Margolis, Westboro, Massachusetts.
I'm Jeb Sharp. Coming up, The World's Carol Hills and Rupa Shenoy take over the show with stories from our Otherhood podcast.
Rupa, remind us what Otherhood is all about.
It's about identity, race, kids of immigrants, and America's kind of evolution into a multicultural majority country.
Cannot wait to hear more. That's just ahead after the news.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. And for the rest of our show today, we're going to highlight one of The World's podcasts. Otherhood is hosted by our own Rupa Shenoy, and she's here with me now. Hey, Rupa.
Hi, Carol. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Rupa, remind us what Otherhood is all about.
It's about identity, race, kids of immigrants, and America's kind of evolution into a multicultural majority country.
And those themes were in a lot of different stories last year.
Yeah, and that was apparent right from the beginning. So I thought we'd start with a chunk of an early 2017 Otherhood episode. It actually took me to Canada, and at the time, we'd just begun to hear stories of people crossing the border from the U.S. on foot, people who were worried they'd be deported if they stayed here. And I visited a clinic outside Toronto where these migrants were being treated for things like frostbite. And the director of the clinic told me I'd blend in with all of the patients.
Edward?
I did blend in with the patients at the refugee clinic. They were an assortment of Africans, South Americans, and others, and I was just another shade of brown. Families were huddled together, talking quietly, waiting to see a doctor. These people were scared. You could see it in their eyes. It wasn't just fear of danger. It was also fear of telling their story and being judged and doubted again. One woman from Venezuela told me people in the U.S. and Canada just don't believe what's happening in her country.
They don't even know where my country is. It is hard to find the food. It's hard to buy milk. That is like a really basic stuff.
Like many patients at the clinic, the woman asked me not to use her name. Her right eye was purple, swollen, puffy. The doctor told her it was caused by stress. She trusts Canada to give her a chance to treat her humanely, even if it doesn't accept her request for asylum. She doesn't trust the U.S. like a scene from some dystopian novel. Families are wading through waist-deep snow, lugging suitcases to cross from the U.S. into Canada, in places where the border is mostly unmarked, unfenced, and unguarded. They're brought to places like the refugee center, where they're treated for advanced frostbite, dehydration, and hypothermia. The clinic's lead doctor, Paul Colford, says they've seen the number of patients like that double.
They've all had cold journeys in the back of trucks to save their lives, literally, by fleeing from, if you can believe this, the United States of America.
They pay smugglers who lock them in trucks to bring them over the border.
One patient described the truck door opening. Several have actually described this. And the words are, "Get out." And they said, "But it's freezing cold," and they're not properly dressed, and they have three children. And they will wait there for 2 to 3 hours because they're getting weaker. They don't know what's happening to them. They've not been in cold exposure before. They don't know about snowbanks and fingers falling off. And, you know, that is what we're actually seeing now, that walks through this door with a harmed or dead hand now, because they were covering the face of their child for 3 hours in a snowbank in Toronto.
The circumstances of those few days and weeks when a refugee family first arrives in a new country, that time is critical. If they get the right resources right then, it puts their lives on a new trajectory, a much better one. To find out how much better, researchers are studying the city of Guelph, about an hour outside Toronto. That's where Jim Estill settles his hand-picked Syrian refugees, 50 families, about 200 people in all. With help from hundreds of volunteers in local churches, synagogues, and mosques, he's set them up with housing, food, healthcare, English language training, and for many, jobs in the appliance factory Jim runs.
I feel now life, new life, good.
Rola and her husband Ahmed are some of the newest arrivals. Rola's still learning English. I tell her she can speak in Arabic if she wants and have Ahmed translate. Jim Estill butts in and says, "Nope. We're not doing it that way. They need to learn English to succeed in Canada."
Just today.
Again, Jim says no. In many ways, he's saved this family, but Jim definitely has his rules.
I don't have a television, and I don't believe in television. But I do come. I have come around. It isn't a bad way to learn English.
Ahmed adds, he's also had to stop smoking. To this, Jim delivers one of his favorite lines.
See, that's the difference between Canada and Syria. In Canada, smoking isn't healthy.
Jim can be corny, but it's his generosity that makes Ahmed emotional.
I mean, I can't look to him. You know why? This guy, I respect him so much. When I come here, before I come, I'm dad. Canada and James give us the good hand. Now our turn to give Canada and James. I promise myself to be good in this country. I feel him like a brother for me. This right now.
In a different life and a different world, Jim and Ahmed could have been business associates. Jim wears a blue work shirt like anyone else at his factory, but he's roughly at the Donald Trump level of business success. He was one of the founding board members of the smartphone company BlackBerry. He started and sold many other big companies, retired young, and then came on to run Danby Appliances. Jim has access to information about all the refugees he's helped and says Ahmed owned the equivalent of a Saks Fifth Avenue in Syria.
He's a business guy like me.
But circumstances in the world have made Jim the one who ended up feeling like he was playing God with other people's lives. He started his effort to bring Syrian families to Canada in 2015. And ever since, people have been emailing him with desperate pleas for help. Before U.S. President Trump took office, Jim was getting a few dozen emails every day. After Trump took office, Jim says the emailed pleas for help multiplied.
It's been a massive increase. Now I'm getting probably 5 times as many. And I've had approaches from people from the States who want to come here.
They tell him they're from one of the 7 countries banned by Trump from entering the U.S. They've applied for protected status in America, but think they'll probably be deported.
They're fearful that they're not going to have a place to stay.
But Jim can't help everyone. He tries to sponsor people he thinks will contribute to Canada's economy and social fabric, mostly nuclear families, preferably with grandparents who will take care of kids while parents work.
I don't tend to sponsor single men. I don't tend to sponsor single mothers.
Jim says half of his families are already working and paying their own way. But some new arrivals are disappointed in the blue-collar factory jobs Jim wants them to work.
You have some people who researched on the internet where the softest country is to come and where the most cushy place to go is and don't necessarily want to work hard, and that goes against my work ethic and whatnot. And so people have to get over that initial hump of saying, I will only do white-collar work. And that's one of the reasons I like bringing families.
Parents are grateful to do anything that means their kids have better lives.
I don't want them to lose gratefulness. I don't want them to be grateful to me. I want them to be grateful for their life. And if you're grateful for your life, you will have more success in life. I guess to some extent, the gratefulness makes up for some of the times when there's not as much gratefulness. And where that happens is where there's a disconnect in expectation. So people read on the internet, when you come to Canada, everything's provided and whatnot, and then you find out, oh, but my couch is used. And they say, oh, I didn't want a used couch, or I wanted a green one, not a blue one.
Before we leave, we have to try the many sweets Rola has laid out for our visit. Baklava, custard, bread. These options don't exactly go with Jim's obsessively healthy diet. But after hundreds of visits to the homes of newly resettled Syrian families, he's stopped fighting the food they insist he eat. So he munches some snacks quickly, leaning against a freezer he bought for Amin and Rola.
This doesn't look as big. But when I was carrying it up four flights of stairs, it was pretty big.
One time he said, you have something you wanted. I said, I want TV. He said, no. Okay, I want the freezer. He said, okay, tomorrow morning I come for freezer. But TV, no.
And Jim's off again, teasing them. Amin and Rola are Canadian now. And that's not how Canadians do things. Or at least, that's not how Jim does things.
Wow, he's kind of tough, but I guess he's generous too. So, Rupa, that episode aired early in 2017 during the winter. What's happened to Guelph since then with Jim and Rula and Ahmed?
Jim's company, Danby Appliances, has sponsored a total of 61 families now, and 58 have made it through the process into Canada. 49 are now working and supporting themselves, he says. There have been some hardships. There have been some bad cases of PTSD. And one father actually died of cancer, leaving a single mother. Everyone's trying to help. Rula and Ahmed were able to bring their second son to Canada. So that kind of eclipses everything else. They're basically over the moon.
I bet. The end of your story there really brought up the notion of identity and what it means to belong. And we're going to explore that a little bit more now, right?
Right. This is from another episode of Otherhood that really touched on our political times here in the U.S. and worldwide. A friend of mine sent me a link to this video the other day. It starts with this music and three kids in separate shots taking a seat in front of a white background. And these kids, I mean, I like kids, but these kids are darn cute. They have big eyes, earnest expressions. They are factually adorable. Abdi's 11. His black hair is buzzed short and his ears stick out. 9-year-old Sarah has long brown, curly hair, cute gaps between her teeth, and a skeptical expression. Rattle's 9 too. He has a mini pompadour, like a little Elvis. Scarlett's the youngest at 7. Her hair's pulled back into two ponytails. From off screen, a voice asks each kid where they're from. They say Denmark. Looking around with expressions that say, what's this about?
Denmark.
Sarah's face is like, duh. The voice says, are you sure? And they're like, yeah. The voice says, why? And they say, because I was born here, and because I was raised here, and because I have friends here. Sarah kind of rolls her eyes. And the voice says, no, you're not Danish. Rattle, the little Elvis, asks, why not? The voice says, people can't just come to Denmark, have kids, and say that those kids are Danish. Rattle thinks about it, smiles a little, and says again, why not? The voice doesn't say anything, and Rattle just stares at whomever's behind the camera, getting sad. Sarah reacts the same way, confused and suddenly unconfident. Abdi says, but I feel Danish.
I feel I'm a dansk.
Scarlett, the youngest, starts to cry. She looks at someone behind the camera, a little resentfully. Then she tucks her head down and curls to her side, trying to hide. Some words appear, superimposed on the background. They say, politicians, please remember who you're talking about. This episode is the backstory to those words written by Scarlett's father, who shot the video and has been accused of child abuse because of it. We'll get to that. But first, I'll explain why I identified like crazy with these kids. Any kid of an immigrant who resettled across the world over the last 50 years probably would too. Because Scarlett's just at that age when we begin to understand that people see us as different. And they really want to define whatever that is. As a kid, I saw that people don't like things that don't fit into neat categories. So I understood the importance of categorizing myself. And it was really sad to me that, at first, I couldn't. Family in India told me, straight up, I wasn't Indian. I didn't walk or talk like an Indian girl. I looked people in the eye. I didn't know my place. Proudly. But Americans seem to question my Americanness, too. When I was a kid, people seemed to ask me a lot if I felt more American or Indian, and being something in between didn't seem like a satisfactory answer. I had one solid thing to fall back on, one solid thing to hang on to, and that was my American citizenship, granted at birth in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Scarlett is a citizen of Denmark, but the Danish parliament issued a statement that seemed to say only those immigrants and their children from Western countries really count as quote-unquote Danish. These were the exact words. Quote, today there are areas in Denmark where the proportion of immigrants and descendants from non-Western countries is over 50%. Parliament believes that Danes should not be in the minority in neighborhoods in Denmark, unquote.
When I saw that, you can't not get worried.
This is Scarlett's dad, Alex Sabor. He was born in Tehran and took the statement from Parliament personally. Even though some lawmakers apologized for the wording, saying it was clumsy, Sabor felt like he had to do something. So he put his own kid and the kids of some friends in front of the camera.
Anybody who has a foreign background who watches this video instantly, and especially if they were raised in Denmark, instantly knows what it is that these kids are going through. Because if you're born in Denmark and you're not of fair skin, you're going to be told you're not Danish.
Alex Sabor, his backstory when we return.
Jeg hedder Abde, og jeg 11 år.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Before the break, Rupa Shenoy from our podcast Otherhood introduced us to Alex Sabor. He's the guy behind a viral video featuring his own child about what it means to be Danish if you were not born in Denmark. Alex Sabor was born in Iran, and that video is very much his story. Here again is Rupa Shenoy.
Sabor thinks of himself as Danish, even though he was raised in California by his mom before moving to Denmark in 1997. Now he's a 32-year-old creative guy from an ad agency, married to a woman who immigrated with her family from Brazil when she was a toddler. Back then, Denmark was a liberal place with a generous welfare system, praised by the likes of Bernie Sanders, with a history of protecting the weak, like Jews during World War II and people fleeing communism during the Cold War.
My perception of Denmark has been changing as I've gotten older. I don't really recall having to deal with, you know, things like racism or discrimination, xenophobia maybe, you know, 10 years ago in the same way that I deal with it now.
Things changed. Denmark's taken a hard line with refugees fleeing Syria. Over the last few years, it put ads in Arabic newspapers telling them to stay away.
course, you know, I love Denmark. I'm very happy to be living here. But at the same time, the state of, you know, how foreigners get treated is, of course, getting a lot worse. You never know what's going to happen. I think it's ridiculous that a family like mine has to have an emergency, you know, exit strategy.
While her parents were considering questions like that, Scarlett's growing up. Sabor keeps contrasting her childhood with the one he had in California.
So Scarlett was 4 years old the first time she asked me, "Dad, where am I from?" Same thing as she's come home crying, saying, my wife is dark-skinned from Brazil. She said how the kids called her a cannibal from the jungle and that she eats people. When I had converted to Islam in 2014, and she went and told the kids at school, and they told her, "Well, yeah, now your dad's a terrorist." And she was very sad and was crying about that. And it's not like she's deaf. She has heard stuff on the television. I did have to tell her when we had to cancel our family vacation because, you know, Trump said that, you know, people with an Iranian background were no longer, you know, welcome to come to the United States, even though we're Danish citizens now. And like in the U.S., when I was living in the U.S., I was an illegal alien my entire time that I was living there. And I was living there for 14 years. And every morning I would take the Pledge of Allegiance, and I don't recall, and I had conversations with my mom, not a single time in my childhood did I ever ask my mom about being Muslim, about being a foreigner, because in the U.S., you get embraced, right? You come into the U.S., and you know what? You're American.
That was true for me. I mean, it was tough growing up different in Iowa. But no one ever questioned my Americanness, because the word American doesn't necessarily imply one specific culture. But it might not work that way with the word Danish in Denmark.
I tell people, like, you know, when they say, "Well, you know, the Muslim culture isn't Danish culture," I'm like, "Well, you know, I understand that, and I'll accept that as an answer. But then again, if Danes don't want to accept all cultures and mixing in with cultures, then there's a lot of other places that we have to look where there's more influence. I mean, being vegan isn't or a vegetarian isn't a Danish thing, but look at how many people are doing that. And, you know, practicing yoga and mindfulness, that's not a Danish culture either. So, I mean, we're very, very influenced. Technology has brought us all close together. So it's a different world. And there's a group of people that don't want to accept and are out of touch with the fact that the world is changing, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
People have attacked Sabor for using children to make that point.
From my perspective, I think it's very strange that people were concerned about the children's safety. So people were taught, I mean, there was a lot of this, is it okay to use kids in a political debate? And that's straight, you know, political spin doctoring. There's been death threats, there's been, you know, very ugly comments. I've had things sent to my house that I'm not particularly happy about.
Do you think this might change something?
I've seen some instances. I've had a lot of people write me that said, "Well, you know, to be honest, you know, I typically like swing a little on the conservative or a little on the right wing. But now that I've seen this, you've put it into perspective." The vast majority of response to the video has been actually very positive. I don't know if it's going to change anything, and it probably is going to change absolutely nothing.
I would ask you, why do you continue to live there? But the answer is it's your home, right?
I do have the opportunity to move. I have a good job, and I have an education, and I'm recognized in my field. So we could very easily come to the States if that's what we wanted to do. And honestly, I would love to move back. I love the U.S. as well. But is it going to be much better over there? I mean, if we look all around the world, I mean, how I'm feeling as a Muslim man in Denmark, my plight is the same as a Muslim man in Holland, or the same as a Muslim man in Idaho. I mean, it's the same story.
I can't help seeing all of this from Scarlett's point of view. When I was her age, I was kind of an outsider in my own family. My dad, mom, and older sister had all come over from India together, and they had things in common from there and from being really poor and scratching together a new life in the States. They had that immigrant grit, but they wanted a different life for me. I wasn't from somewhere like them. So the American identity became my haven. If I had been denied that, I don't know who I would have been or who I'd be now. It's frankly a terrifying thought. I didn't realize until I saw Scarlett crying that what she's experiencing now is my worst nightmare.
Rupa Shenoy with an episode of Otherhood from 2017. Rupa, what's the update from Denmark? Is the government still talking about who is and isn't Danish? And how are the kids in that video doing?
Alex says the kids are fine. They're still facing the challenges of growing up different in Denmark. But they didn't suffer any blowback from the video. And in Denmark, from Alex's point of view, things are getting worse, and the government is still talking about who is and isn't Danish. He points to extreme rhetoric from the right-wing-led government about things like refugees not doing enough to provide for themselves. And 3 months ago, Denmark announced it wouldn't allow the UN to resettle any more refugees in the country this year, and it will look for more flexibility in the future rather than follow the UN's refugee quota, which Denmark has been doing for decades.
Let's hope 2018 is a bright one for Alex Sabor and his family. Rupa, thanks a lot for sharing with us.
Thanks, Carol.
Rupa Shenoy of the World's Otherhood podcast, which you can find on any podcast provider. A new season is in the making as we speak. Look out for that. You can always tweet Rupa with ideas or comments at Rupa Shenoy. And that'll do it for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Happy New Year. We're back on the radio tomorrow.
Public Radio International.